Catherine Austin Fitz is the founder and president of Solari. She served as managing director and member of the board of directors of the Wall Street Investment Bank, Dillon Reed & Company. She has also served as assistant secretary of housing, federal housing commissioner at HUD. She was president and founder of Hamilton Securities Group, and Catherine has a BA from the University of Pennsylvania, an MBA from the Wharton School, and studied Chinese at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Catherine serves on the board of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and she publishes a column, Mapping the Real Deal, in Scoop Media in New Zealand. She is our guest on Coast to Coast. Hello, Catherine. How are you?
Hi, George. What a pleasure to be on with you.
My brother-in-law, my favorite brother-in-law, and I should tell you, my only brother-in-law, also went to the Wharton School.
Oh, really?
I'm telling you, you come out of that school, and you're rubber stamped for a pretty good future, aren't you?
That is true. That is true.
Yep, he picked that years ago, and he never regretted it at all. How did you get involved in looking for some of these black ops budgets we're going to talk about today?
Well, I became Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration, and my first order from then Secretary Jack Kemp was go downstairs and clean this place up. It's a mess. it was at the end of the 80s, so it was at the end of all the SNL failures.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, the real estate market had tanked, the bubble had burst.
Which caused the problem for the SNLs, right?
I would say that black budget fraud caused all the problems for the SNLs.
Well, you know what? You may be right. Of course, we don't know about that yet. We will by the end of this program.
That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah, but you're right. The perception from all of us was that regulators, you know, changed the ratio for SNLs, and you know they didn't have enough capital, and the real estate market, as you say, tanked.
Well, there was certainly sort of a pump and dump of the real estate market with the help of regulatory policies. You know, but the question is who let that happen and why. You know, I always say that crime that pays is crime that stays. Because I think if you look at who got away with what money, it was clear we had a white-collar crime epidemic. And if I could tell a couple stories about how I first, you know, because I didn't land at HUD and say, oh, I'm going to clean up black budget fraud. I didn't even know what a black budget was at the time. I started as assistant secretary at the FHA, with the Federal Housing Administration.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I walked in the first day, and I said to the guy who ran the money, the controller, I said, I'd like to see our financial statements. And he said, well, we don't have financial statements. We only get audited every couple years.
Every couple years.
So I said, well, let me see the budgets. And so he brought me in a stack of budgets that would go all the way from on your desk all the way up to the ceiling. And I read them four times, called them back in. And I said, you know, under the law, we're required to be self-supporting. We're supposed to charge enough for mortgage insurance to pay for all of our expenses and the losses we incur when mortgages default. But I can't tell whether we're making or losing money, so I can't tell if we're in compliance with the law. Where do I find the numbers? And he said, well, that's not in the budget. And I said, well, where is it? And he said, the accountants have that information. And I said, well, where are the accountants? I want to talk to them. And he said, they report to a different assistant secretary. You're not allowed to talk to them.
Now, who made up this bureaucracy?
So I said to him, I raised a lot of money for George Bush, so I'm going to get this changed. In about 2 months of lobbying, we got the accounts moved over to report to us, and I discovered in the single family fund alone, we were losing $11 million a day.
$11 million a day.
Right. So that was the first 24 hours of the accounts are reporting to me. So I said, well, all real estate is local. Where are we losing the money? And they said, well, we don't keep that information. I said, well, we have 80 field offices. What do I tell the field office managers? It's an emergency. Go figure out, you know, how much cash we're taking in and sending out, you know, by office. And they came back 2 months later, another 2 months, and said, we're making money in 8 regions and we're losing money in 2 regions. This is 1989. Can you guess what 2 regions we were losing money in, George?
No, I'm not even going to take a stab at it.
Texas and Colorado.
Texas and Colorado?
And remember, the federal Texas region included Arkansas, so you had both the Clintons and the Bushes in the same.
Sure. That's right.
Anyway, it turned out, I called the regional deputy administrator in Texas, and I said, Sam, how much do you think you lost last year? And he said, oh, I think we broke even. And I said, no, you lost $2 billion.
And they didn't even know it. They didn't even know it.
They didn't even know.
You know, if we did that with our own personal budget, we'd be out of business.
Right. And what I discovered as we started to do what I call place-based financial disclosure, which is, you know, let's look at how the money works by place, I think we had a white-collar crime epidemic, because if you take the numbers for the SNL losses and the numbers for the HUD losses and everything else, and you lay them out against, you know, so what I describe as sort of government systemic financial fraud, there was essentially a white-collar crime. You know, we pumped and dumped the real estate market, but that was not all by accident.
Okay, now you were, of course, the Assistant Secretary of Housing under a Republican administration.
Yes.
Let me ask you, is this what you've uncovered about these black ops, which we're going to get into? Did this skew all parties involved here, or was it just Democrats?
Everything I saw was completely bipartisan. My company was hired back at, when I left HUD in 1990, I started a company which several years later was hired back on competitive contract to the Clinton administration.
All right.
I ran into the same problems, the same issues, and ultimately the company was fired by the Clinton administration. So, George, I'm speaking to you as a person who's been fired by both Republicans and Democrats.
Okay, so this is a problem of government, not about party.
No, actually, it's not a problem of government because, in fact, you know, I would submit to you, as a financial matter, there is no government. What you found as you dug much deeper is the political appointees came and go and turned over fairly quickly, but beneath them was an infrastructure of defense contractors and the big New York Federal Reserve banks. And the agencies were really run at that deeper level,
uh-huh.
You know, through contracts. And in fact, if, you know, to have a sovereign government, George, you need to have control. Government officials need to have control of your information systems and your bank accounts. And literally, we have a situation where the creditors, or companies that are owned by the creditors, literally control and operate the information systems and the bank accounts. If you had a company that was essentially, you know, needed to borrow money to keep its operations going, and the people who were financing your operations controlled your information
mm-hmm.
systems and bank accounts, I dare say you wouldn't really run the company, would you?
No, not at all. You're kind of like a figurehead.
Right.
Well, now where did they get the money, Catherine? Because, I mean, they can't be getting it just from our taxes. So
let's,
are they just borrowing?
Yeah, let's go back.
And also back off your phone just a little bit when
okay.
you talk to me, okay?
Okay, let's go back and look at sort of the history of the black budget mechanism.
Okay.
In 1947, we passed a law called the National Security Act. And then in 1949, we passed a law called the CIA Act. And those two laws gave the intelligence community a legal mechanism whereby they could draw money out of other agencies' budgets with no transparency and no disclosure.
You mean these other agencies wouldn't even know about it?
Well, in theory, somebody in the agency might know about
it. Yeah, I mean, if somebody took $500 out of my checking account, I would hope I'd know about it.
Well, I believe today, if for example, in fiscal 1998, there was $59 billion missing from HUD, and my best guess of what happened is, in fact, money was stolen out of HUD, and I doubt there's a government official who knows anything about it.
My gosh.
Because now with the computers and software like Promise Software and its successor systems, you can, you know, working through the government contractors and the big banks, you can pull that kind of money out of an agency.
Instantly.
Well, there are two issues, and that's
quietly.
Why I'm glad you brought up there's something other than taxes, and that is securities.
Yes.
Because let's say the Department of Defense was missing $2.3 trillion. It was, I believe it was fiscal 99 or fiscal 2000.
I love that. Missing.
It's called undocumentable adjustments is what, and this is from the official financial statements of the government. But how can the Department of Defense be missing $2.3 trillion in a year when total taxes was $1.6 trillion?
Now, when somebody asks, or do they, where did it go? Is it like public policy not to ask? Because you may end up in the bottom of some river?
Well, there are different games that are played when people ask where the money's going. For example, one game is to blame government incompetence. So in 1998, HUD was missing $59 billion, and when asked about it, the Inspector General said, well, this is terrible. You know, the systems don't talk to each other. we're not going to produce audited financial statements. We're not going to figure out where the missing money went. We're simply going to promise you that it won't happen again next year.
Well, and I got to tell you, even with audited statements, I don't have much trust in those anymore either when you've seen what has happened to some of these publicly traded companies and their auditors.
Well, but let me tell you how bad it is. I mean, at least Enron knew they were obligated to cook the books.
Yeah.
I was part of a group of people who worked mightily to persuade OMB to produce audited financial statements and then got laws passed to require it. And the government was supposed to produce audited financial statements starting in 1995. To date, they have never once produced audited financial statements. That's both the Clinton and the Bush administrations. And to our knowledge, $4 trillion has been reported undocumentable adjustments. And at the end of 2004, right after the election, the U.S. Treasury increased its liabilities in a write-up of $11 trillion, again, at refusing to produce audited financial statements. So Enron cooked its books, but the federal government doesn't even bother to cook its books. It just refuses to produce its books.
Are you saying that $4 trillion
that we know of
is missing?
Yeah.
It's gone.
There's $3.3 trillion that's been reported missing from the Department of Defense.
How much of this might have been or sitting in individuals' bank accounts, too? Not CIA black ops and things that they're trying to do clandestinely. How much money do you think has gone to individuals?
I think a significant amount, in the sense that to move this much money and to launder this much money, you need to provide personnel benefits to all the different companies and people doing it.
For them to turn away.
A lot of money.
I think you're right.
If you look at the centralization of economic and political power in this country over the last 30 years, the primary financial mechanism is financial fraud and organized crime. And that's deeply connected to the black budget.
So, you know, when we just think of black budgets, so they're using this for some war somewhere, it's bigger than that, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think let me walk through sort of how this evolved, because when you hear someone like me describe, you know, $4 trillion, you think, well, it could never be happening, it could never be that big. And it helps to go back and understand how this thing has grown up, because it's taken about 100 years to get it to this point.
Let me make some zeros here, by the way, and see what $4 trillion looks like. That is...
Well, it's about $12,000 per American resident.
12 zeros.
So George, your government has lost $14,000 of your money.
14 grand out the window.
You're out 14 grand. Imagine if your bank sent you a statement and said, you know, we have $14,000 of undocumentable adjustments in your bank account, and we just want you to write it off.
That would leave me with a debit of about $15,000 in that case.
Well, let me tell you my chief concern, and I can go back and tell you the different stories on how I came to believe this. But my chief concern is the way that you could be missing $2.3 trillion in a year when we only paid $1.6 trillion in taxes is if you engage in significant securities fraud.
All right, tell me why.
Okay, let's say I have $100 million in Treasury, in the U.S. Treasury, or at HUD or Department of Defense.
In cash, right?
In cash. I pull it out, and with that cash, I then buy $100 million of U.S. Treasury. So the money goes back into the U.S. Treasury.
So that's that, but that's a balance, right? That's balanced.
Right, I now have $100 million of Treasury bills, which I can sell around the world because, right, they're top-rated securities.
I'm with you.
Okay, so I end up not with $2.3 trillion in cash, but $2.3 trillion of securities, which are off the books. Because obviously if we put them on the books, then somebody would say, hey, wait a minute, how come the liabilities went up so much?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my chief concern with the write-up of the liabilities at the end of 2004 is that, in fact, that's a move to authenticate all of the fraudulently issued securities.
All over the place.
Well, that's a, you know... Here's the problem, George, since we can't trust their books. The numbers I'm giving you are from the official U.S. Treasury accounts in these years, but they're not books that are audited and trustworthy in my opinion.
It's got to be 2, 3, 4, who knows how many times worse than that.
Right, and the one thing I can tell you as somebody who served as an Assistant Secretary of Housing and then as the Senior Financial Advisor to a government agency, that this is not a matter of incompetence. I can't tell you how many competent, able people I met working in government.
And are they aware of this?
Well, I think what they're aware of, let me give you an example. In the summer of 2000, I went to meet with the chief of staff to the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee for the Department of Housing and Urban Development
for
bond.
Okay.
And I was, my company's owed money by HUD, and I was just, I'm in litigation with HUD, so I was just trying to get my company collected because I have a lot of people who deserve to be paid.
Sure.
And so I went in to see them, and they said, what do you think is going on at HUD? And I was trying to be discreet, and I said, I don't know, what do you think is going on at HUD? And they looked me dead in the eye, George, and said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. And it was, it took me about 12 years to come to that conclusion, but I said to them, I don't disagree. Now, if you know, if you understand what I understand, then you know that HUD is run by J.P. Morgan Chase, the Department of Justice, the U.S. Treasury, at the time Lockheed Martin was paid about $150 million-plus a year to run all of HUD's systems and accounts, and that there's no way HUD can be run as a criminal enterprise unless that group of contractors and banks...
were part of it.
...are running it that way. I mean, you can't have $4 trillion. The depository for the U.S. government is the New York Fed. But the New York Fed runs, and the New York Fed runs the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is the big legally authorized slush fund for the government, which I believe in combination with the 47 and 49 Act allow essentially the black budget to source and use huge amounts of financial operations. Not just to finance the black budget, but to use black budget funds to manipulate the stock, bond, gold, and other financial markets, particularly and including the housing bubble, which is something I'd love to touch on because it touches every, I'm sure, every listener you have.
In how many different agencies have their hand in the cookie jar? Black ops or otherwise?
Well, I think our world is a little bit... Have you ever been to Disney World, George?
I have not yet been to Disney World.
But I've seen... I had a friend who took the course. You know, they have a management course where you go underneath the ground and you see how... You know, you have this lovely world above ground that's totally orchestrated, and then you have this whole world below ground that's sort of manipulating and organizing it. And I think our world is very much like that. You have... You know, you have the overt world, and then you have the covert world. And the covert world is everywhere. I mean, it's in every neighborhood. I always tell people, if you want to stop the black budget, cut off their cash flow in your neighborhood, because the black budget finances one neighborhood at a time.
What is this? I'm going to go to a break, and then we're going to come back. But
okay.
I want you to think about this question. What is it that this covert group with this budget wants to do? I mean, you know, once you get to $2.3 or $4 trillion, how much more do you need? There's got to be a bigger picture here, Catherine. They're up to something, and I want to get your take on that. Lots more to talk about when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, before we get into some of these covert budgets, you were talking about the chronology of how you believe this all started, and we got so excited we got sidetracked a little bit. So why don't you pick that up from years gone back?
We passed a series of laws with the National Security Act and the CIA Act that permitted, it created a loophole that lets the intelligence agencies, using the securities and financial mechanism of the Treasury, basically draw huge amounts of money in and out of the financial markets with essentially zero transparency and accountability. So, you know, we kind of created the siphon. And then in 1980, we added a series of executive orders. One was an executive order that put George H.W. Bush in charge of the National Security Council and enforcement and intelligence infrastructure. So we had the former head of the CIA basically running that mechanism and understanding how to manipulate it. And then, in addition, we implemented an executive order that said private corporations could handle, through government contract, highly sensitive national security operations. And so we create, you know, so here we have a non-transparent way to basically siphon a near infinite amount of money to big corporations with no accountability and transparency. And then on top of it, we pass what, thanks to Gary Webb, we know about is, or we created a memorandum of between the Department of Justice and the CIA, thanks to Stanley Sporkin and Casey at CIA, that said basically, you know, if the CIA knows of drug dealing by its by its operations, including its contractors, it doesn't have to report it. And that kind of, you know, that the combination of those legal and executive order infrastructures, George, created a mechanism that was really a license to steal. And we watched Iran-Contra kind of evolve, and the financial fraud in Iran-Contra that I then cleaned up, both at HUD and I was on a cleanup team for BCCI.
Oh, my, that was
a mess.
Literally
explode.
That was a disaster.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, Harry Albright, who was the trustee appointed by Morgenthau, or that Morgenthau arranged through the courts, had asked me to go on the board of First American, which was the Clark Clifford, you know, sort of Wonder Woman husband bank in Washington,
that's right.
Part of BCCI. And so Harry asked me if I would do it, and he sent out, you know, like a Brinks truck with thousands of pages of documents. I was living out in McLean, and I got, you know, they filled up my living room, and I spent several days just reading it. And when it was over, I just put, you know, after cleaning up Iran-Contra fraud, I thought I'd seen it all at HUD. But after I read those documents, George, what I realized is, you know, this could only have happened if it was approved at the highest levels. There's no way that kind of fraudulent behavior could go on unless the New York Fed and the Federal Reserve and the White House wanted it.
Everybody knew about it, too, at the highest level.
Well, I don't know if everybody knew about it, because certainly Harry Albright was no, you know, outsider. He's a pretty savvy guy. He'd been chairman of the Dime Savings Bank. But, you know, it was after that that Harry said to me, you know, I'm just leaving for Florida and retiring. I remember I had dinner with him, and he said, you know, at the beginning of the Bush administration, we were selling 40% of the arms to the world, and now we're selling 70%, and this thing is out of control.
Isn't that also what did in Noriega part of it, the BCCI scandal?
You know, I suspect it was that was a turf war, and there were a combination of things involved. But I think, you know, over time what we've seen is a process where sort of what I would call the corporate guys have squeezed out the thugs and mugs that they had fronting for them.
Well, let me ask you this, Catherine, before we get more into the nitty-gritty of this. Let's all assume you're absolutely correct, and we have no reason to believe you're not, that they are siphoning off trillions of dollars. What do they want? I mean, what's the game here? I mean,
well, I think there's a combination of things. I don't think it's a simple they, and I don't think it's let's talk about one of the most important dynamics. America's rise to power has been fueled by America producing this machinery that produces the lowest cost of capital. I mean, you know, George, if you want to buy a car and you have to borrow money at 10% and your neighbor can borrow at 5%, he's going to be able to pay a lot more and get the car or the house or whatever.
That's right.
So cost of capital matters, and my motto is the guy with the lowest cost of capital wins. You know, well, let me tell you something. If I'm a group of franchise operations and my investors are dealing drugs into your neighborhood, then I can finance, you know, taking over your market share in your neighborhood for less than zero. Okay, so it's called a neighborhood leverage buyout. In the game of economic warfare, the guy with the lowest cost of capital wins, and traditionally the people who could combine organized crime with government securities, with stock market, you know, finance companies can get the highest cost of capital. And so, and the sad thing about all of this, so America's rise to power has been fueled by dirty money, and there's a lot of popular support for that. The crowd votes for the guy with the money. Let me just tell you one story, because it's very important to understand how deep this political dynamic is.
Sure.
In the summer of 2000, I spoke to a wonderful group of people called the Spiritual Frontiers International Foundation. They go off into the woods once a year, George, to talk about how they can help our society evolve spiritually. Very intelligent, dedicated group of people. And I was talking to them about the CIA Inspector General report, you know, sort of Stanley Sporkin and the CIA Iran-Contra drug dealing, and the fact that the Department of Justice, when the CIA Inspector General report about all that came out in 1998, had said that the U.S. financial system laundered $500 billion to $1 trillion a year. So I said to this lovely group of 100 people, what would happen if we stopped being the worldwide leader in laundering dirty money? And what would happen if we stopped laundering, you know, sort of, and doing narcotics trafficking in every neighborhood in America? So we had a little discussion, and they said, well, you know, the stock market would go down because that money would, you know, go to the Hong Kong stock market, and our government checks, we might have trouble financing the deficit, so our taxes might go up or our even worse, our government checks might stop. So I said, okay, well, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern. If you push this button, you can stop all narcotics trafficking in your neighborhood tomorrow, your neighborhood, your city, your county, your state, your country. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, guess how many would push the button?
None.
One. So I said to the other 99, why would you not push the button? And they said, we don't want our mutual funds to go down, and we don't want our government checks to stop. And that's what I call the red button problem, which is America has fueled its rise to power on low cost of capital, and we are all financially dependent on dirty money.
And we have all created a lifestyle that a lot of people, not everyone, enjoys. I mean, there are a lot of people struggling every day.
Right.
But overall, you know, I would guess that most people have surveyed a pretty okay. They're comfortable. They wouldn't want to live in a third world nation. I'll tell you that.
Absolutely.
So they have their two cars, maybe, and they've got their jobs, maybe. And again, I'm talking about the people who are gainfully employed and things like that. So overall, I think you're right. Most people wouldn't want to make a change. And I would also guess, Catherine, that they don't want to know about this. They would like to stick their heads in the sand and say, I don't want to hear this.
Right. Well, I think what happened was, if you remember, you know, George Kennan said at the end of World War II, he said, we have 6% of the people and 50% of the resources. Something's got it. You know, we're going to have to drop a lot of bombs and kick people around to keep this going. And if you remember, Goldwater, when he ran for president, said, you know, we're going to have to drop a lot of bombs and be tough. And the American people said, no, you know, we don't want to be like that. And then Jimmy Carter, you know, said, okay, well, you know, I'm going to shiver in front of the fireplace. We're going to have to cut back. And the American people said, no, we don't want to do that. And the Bushes came along and said, listen, guys, you're good Christians. Here's your check. Don't ask questions. And you know, we've kind of gone along with that.
Yeah, we have.
We have. And so I think there are several problems. One is that since the crucifixion of Jesus, the political formula that we've been operating on is the crowd votes for the criminals.
That was a long time ago, too.
Well, but, you know, it's the same. I have an article called Where Would Jesus Bank? And basically I take that story. Let me tell you another story, because it's really important to understand sort of the deep addiction here and the contradiction. I was at a Christian, this is the summer of 2000, again, I was at a Christian revival, Women Out Loose, T.D. Jakes does, had in Atlanta. So there's 100,000 Afro-American women praying together in the Georgia Dome. I'm there with my church. And George W. Bush comes in on the monitor. T.D. Jakes' ministry is in Texas, so he has George Bush come in on, and it's before the election. And 100,000 Afro-American women jump up cheering, including a minister who's teaching me spiritual warfare. He used to work at the DEA, and there's nothing about Bush family involvement in narcotics trafficking that she doesn't know. So I said, when it was over, I said, Patricia, listen, I've lost $6 million in cash, $250 million in equity, almost lost my life trying to stop, you know, Bush and Clinton family narcotics trafficking. And you never jumped up and clapped and cheered for me. Why'd you jump up and cheer for him? She said, he's going to be the winner. And I said, you mean so he's the winner and I'm the loser? And she said, that's right.
All right, now let me ask you something. You just said something about narcotics trafficking. I want you to explain that.
Let me jump back. When I left the Bush administration, I felt very strongly that if communities were going to be wonderful in America, we had to get government control and government money out of communities. So we had to be able to finance communities privately with equity. So I started a company to do that. And one of the things we were doing, George, is making a software tool called Community Wizard.
Are you a whistleblower, by the way?
No, actually, I was the target of a whistleblower.
You were.
Have you ever seen the movie Enemy of the State with Will Smith and Gene Hackman?
Yes, good movie.
I played Will Smith in real life.
Okay.
You know, he's a rich, successful, you know, high-flying Washington know-it-all.
Yep.
And the next thing you know, he's targeted by whistleblowers.
All right, we'll talk about that.
Okay. So, I was building a software tool called Community Wizard. Now, what I discovered when I was working as Assistant Secretary of Housing is we had neighborhoods where we were paying $150,000 to $250,000 per apartment building units to build housing when $50,000 would buy and rehab single-family housing.
Right. So why'd we spend so much?
Right. Or, you know, we were paying a contractor, a federal government contractor, $35 to $150 an hour to do something that somebody in that neighborhood would love to do for $20 plus health care.
Sure.
So what I found when I was assistant secretary is it wasn't politically feasible for me to change these things,
mm-hmm.
to, you know, what's called re-engineer government. But if the community could have access, and then the community as taxpayers could come in and say, look, let me show you how you can have five homes for the price of one, then a government official can't say, oh, well, we want to spend five times what's necessary
so we can
generate fees for our friends.
So they're trapped if somebody did that.
They're not trapped, but it completely shifts the political equation, and what it means is that small businesses and local organizations can do much better where they can perform better with taxpayers' resources. So it's kind of a win-win except for, you know, the friends of whoever is, you know, trying to generate fees for their pals and black budget, you know, covert stuff. So illumination and transparency really does shift things in a pretty wonderful way. Anyway, so we're making the software tool, and literally what happened was they were doing a series of things that gave offense, including helping small businesses finance privately with equity, which meant it was much harder for the big businesses if we had been allowed to continue to take over markets and communities. So what happened was in 1998, under the leadership of Stanley Sporkin, do you remember Stanley Sporkin,
yes.
Former general counsel of the CIA?
Yes.
Our offices were seized and all of our software tools and databases were destroyed. We had just, George, put up a series of maps on the Internet using Community Wizard that showed patterns of default on HUD single-family homes in a series of neighborhoods. One of them was South Central L.A., and so while Gary Webb was publishing the Dark Alliance story, we were publishing maps that showed what appeared to be patterns of money laundering with using mortgage fraud to launder CIA narcotics trafficking. When I first showed these maps, they were GIS software maps to Mike Rupert.
Yes.
Who was a narcotics...
police officer.
Police investigator in South Central L.A. He looked at it and said, oh, my God, do you understand what this map says?
I mean, was this the first time he saw this?
I first found, like, in 1998, Mike Rupert saved my life, literally, because I was in Washington. I was living through 24-hour physical harassment and surveillance, you know, and I was going down, George.
Well, I'm going to ask you later why you're still alive.
Well, because, you know, I would say there was divine intercession, but a lot of people helped. It's amazing how many people it takes to save someone like me. And Rupert can tell you the stories. But what happened was, I don't know, did you ever see the Tony Soprano TV shows on HUD fraud?
You know, I'm not. I've seen a couple Soprano shows, not a lot.
About a year ago, did a series on HUD fraud that was really remarkable. But what it showed was the basic real estate fraud. One of the basic real estate frauds that I think has been used to finance the black budget.
How does it work? Real quickly, tell us how.
Real quickly, let's say I've made $100,000 dealing drugs in South Central L.A. I take the $100,000.
Okay, you sell cocaine. You make
$100,000. Right. Make $100,000. I buy a HUD home, a home, and I do some schlock rehab. Let's say I do $25,000 of schlock rehab. I get a phony baloney appraisal that says it's worth $250,000. I sell it to a buyer who uses a HUD loan to buy it.
Is it a real buyer?
No, it's a straw buyer.
Straw buyer.
He's the real guy, but he's planning on defaulting.
He's part of the plan.
Right, he's part of the plan. So now I have $250,000, plus it came from a legitimate deal, so it's laundered. Okay.
And what have you done with your $100,000 cash? You can't walk into a bank with that.
Well, now I can, because I got it from a legitimate closing. I got it from, you know.
You can walk in with a briefcase of $100,000 cash nowadays?
No.
Let's start with $100,000 cash you got on the street selling drugs.
Right.
What do you do with that? Physically.
I buy a home.
No, I mean, but how do you do that? I mean, do you put it in your checking account? What do you do with it?
No, you buy the house, and the guy who sells the house puts it in his checking account.
So you give that guy the $100,000 cash.
Well, that's one way you can do it. I mean, the problem with money laundering, George, is it's like the joy of cooking. There are thousands of recipes.
Yeah, but I mean, somewhere along the line, somebody gets that cash, right?
Somebody gets that cash, absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, but once I roll it through the property and I've got my $250,000 back minus expenses, let's say I net $200,000.
All right.
But that's a quick $75,000 profit. Now, you know, if I do that five times on a property or on a series of properties in a neighborhood, I can come out with a couple $100,000. Now, let me show you how I can beat even that. Let's say, since if there's complicity of the people running HUD with this, let's say I issue mortgage-backed securities, and I issue 10 mortgages on each home. And then I play that real estate fraud not to get cash, but to pay the debt service on those mortgage securities. I can end up laundering $1 million of crack cocaine cash into a couple $100 million.
You mean they've used the same collateral over and over and over again?
Well, let me tell you a story. In 1995, when the first financial statements, the audited financial statements, were supposed to be reported, HUD did produce an attempt at audited financial statements. And I was at Hamilton, my company in Washington, and a friend came to me and said, look, I have a very wonderful mortgage banker from New York. He's very upset. He's very distraught. He needs to talk to you. And he wants me to get an appointment. So I agreed to see him, and he came into the office, and he, very serious engineer kind of guy, and he said to me, you know, my family's been in the mortgage banking business for three generations, and our core competency is we track all government-insured mortgages, Federal Housing Administration,
right.
Ginnie Mae, everything. And he said, and he had a huge pile of documents, and he said, I brought you a copy of my database. He said, there's a terrible mistake. The amount of outstanding mortgage and mortgage-backed securities is many multiples of what's shown here in these official financial statements.
When we come back, I want you to continue with that story. I'm George Norrie. Catherine Austin Fitz, our guest. My, oh, my, it gets deeper, doesn't it? Fitz, so, Catherine, are you saying that in order to finance these black op budgets that they have to do it fraudulently because there's, one, not enough money to do it or it wouldn't be approved? Why do they want to do it this way?
Well, I think it's much worse than that. Because I don't think I think they're financing black budgets, but I also think they're financing centralized control of resources. Let me tell you another story.
And finish your mortgage story too, okay?
Okay. In the summer of 1997, I was giving a presentation to a group of top pension fund investors on the Solari model, which is sort of my vision of how we get out of this situation,
mm-hmm.
and finance communities with equity and kind of turn things around. And one of the guy was the president of CalPERS, which is the largest pension fund in the country. It's the California state employees. And he looked at me and he said, you don't understand. It's too late. They have given up on the country. They are moving all the money out of the country starting in the fall.
Who's they?
They are moving it to Asia. He said, you've got to get to Nick Brady, who's my old partner on Wall Street, but who had been Secretary of the Treasury.
Okay.
And that fall, George, was when the $4 trillion started to go missing from the federal government and the pump and dump of the stock market, the dot-coms, the telecoms started. And my estimation is, if you count the $4 trillion and then what got pulled out of pension funds through the pump and dump of the stock market and retail investors, my estimation is approximately $10 trillion got moved, and according to Bill, it was going to be reinvested abroad. Now, my biggest fear for the American people is that that money is now coming back in, and as the economy slows down, and in some places very dramatically, that money is coming back in and essentially buying up all of our land, water, municipal assets, and resources out from under us, because as the dollar falls, that money's worth, you know, if it was worth $10 trillion when it left, it's worth a lot more.
Who sent it out?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I can tell you who was complicit in allowing the $4 trillion of undocumentable adjustments and not doing anything about it. I mean, you have the two secretaries of the Treasury. You have Bob Rubin, Larry Summers. O'Neill left in a huff. O'Neill tried to put up much more financial disclosure and got booted, and the financial disclosure got pulled out in a pattern that's very similar to what happened to me.
Well, now explain this for us, Catherine. So the money goes, it goes out fraudulently, of course. And then,
well, that's what we're guessing.
And then comes back to buy resources and land and
right,
things like that.
Right, let me give you an
example. Well, who's buying it?
Well, it's as the money moved out, there are certain players who have done very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
We are centralizing the economy. Let's take, for example, Carlyle Group. Carlyle Group started in the 80s. They were kind of a nobody and nothing, and all of a sudden, as the missing money goes missing, they explode with lots of investment and now are, I think, the 11th largest defense contractor in the country.
And they bought a lot of these companies undervalued, and then
they bought companies, and then they got contracts.
Yeah, that's right.
If I have a stock, and then, if you look at the story of Enron, Harvard puts out studies saying we ought to deregulate energy. Those studies get taken to the government. The government suddenly, outsources all their energy purchases to Enron. Enron stock flies up. That's called pump and dump stock market fraud using government contracts.
In some cases, you don't even have to bid, do you?
Right. All these things can be arranged in the overt world if you know how to do it, and you can work cross-government in the private sector.
All right. Making the assumption this is going on, how much more money do these organizations, do these people, whoever they may be? I call them the Illuminati. I think we're talking about the same thing. What are they going to do with it all?
Well,
if you got 10...
My fear is that they're going to... what we saw between 1998 and September 2001 was a financial coup d'etat. And in September 10th of 2001, Rumsfeld was pressed about the $2.3 missing money at a press conference. I was working with reporters in Washington coming out with big stories during the appropriation process, and I said to the reporter, literally the day before 9/11, nothing can stop this from going mainstream now. And then 9/11 happened. And my question with 9/11 is, one, did it slam the door on the $4 trillion of missing money being ever found, number one? But number two, was it a mechanism to move the black budget on budget? Because as a result of 9/11 and the Patriot Act and that whole process, DOD has been relieved from a lot of their financial reporting requirements. And suddenly, if you look at any of my estimations of the size of the black budget before September 11th, 2001, and you look at how much the defense budget has increased, it's remarkable. One wonders if they just got tired of running around and doing all this financial fraud and narcotics trafficking and decided, we just need more control and we need to get the black budget on budget.
So let's go for the gusto.
Yeah. It's very hard if you really study what happened on 9/11, and more importantly, Judge George, I have an article called 9/11 Profiteering where I estimate the different areas of ways that people made money on 9/11. My guess is it was the most profitable covert operations in the history of piracy. And, it's impossible to explain the sort of facts without assuming that that some faction inside was complicit.
I was going to say, you're now treading on some very thin ice, Catherine, so I want you to be very specific on some of the things we say here. I have a theory, and I've always said it, follow the money.
Right.
Who benefits,
right,
and you'll find a lot of things.
Right.
Now, since you've brought it up, I'm going to ask you, do you have any doubts at all that these crazed Islamic fundamentalists were part of this?
I think if crazed Islamic fundamentalists were part of it, it was as an unimportant part, certainly not a controlling part.
What if they were the tool?
They could have been a tool, but serious money does not bank an operation like that, with Looney Tunes people in critical roles. If I'm an investor and I'm banking a covert operation, I'm just not going to bank something that's dependent on somebody who's volatile or amateurish or not
a
serious player.
Would this be a worldwide conspiracy?
Well, I think, you know, in my experience, George, things are pretty fractured. I'm not saying that the financial system isn't highly centralized, but it's a very big planet, and it's very hard to run things. And my history, my read of the history of sort of dirty money in the United States is if you're one faction and you're competing with other factions and the crowd continually votes for the guy who has the most money, then if they do dirty and you don't do dirty, then they win and kill you.
Now, there are some people who would call you ridiculous, crazy, unpatriotic, God knows what. Do they not listen? Do they not want to hear?
I very, very rarely get called crazy or unpatriotic. It's just, it's very unusual. Because I can't, you know, my focus is very much on money, and I tend to work from official documentation and official sources. And I try and follow, you know, sort of how money works. Now, I engage in conjecture in the sense that I'm a founder of a website with a group of people called Unanswered Questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a great believer that, you know, when you're trying to understand a system whole, when you're trying to understand the patterns of money around an event, you know, qui bono, who benefits, the only way you can start to understand these things is by asking lots of questions. And researchers all over the world who ask questions and collaborate can come up with remarkable amounts of information. You know, even though we don't have the resources of a CIA or an NSA or a professional intelligence, you know, certainly.
Well, let me ask you, were in the securities field. Somebody sold stock short, airlines and insurance companies, prior to 9/11. Who did that? Because the SEC has never told us. Now, wouldn't that?
I don't know. And in fact, what I think is a much more significant fact is that the SEC won't say.
But they know, don't they?
They can know if they want to. I mean, they certainly have the authority and the legal powers to know.
They'd at least know what brokerage firms place the orders.
Well, it's funny. There were two attorneys who were particularly venal in trying to frame me.
What do you mean, frame you? Frame you for what?
George, when I was targeted in this enemy of the state thing, I went through 18 audits and investigations, 12 pieces of litigation with the Department of Justice and the government and their whistleblowers. So I've had, you know, sort of an outward bound legal degree dealing with these guys, and the single most, one of the most venal attorneys who lied the most, you know, I've got them on transcripts, you know, in court documents with Sporkin behind seal lying that's now been unsealed. He, you know, when he failed to frame me and quit and left his law firm, he went to work for enforcement at the SEC. Well, let me tell you how bad things are. When I did a series of articles and shows on Enron.
Right.
Enron, the chairman of the finance committee at Enron was Pug Whitaker. Pug Whitaker was the former chairman and lead investor in DynCorp. Okay? So here's DynCorp's single largest outside investor who's supposed to be investigated by the SEC and the Department of Justice. Who runs the SEC information systems and the Department of Justice information systems in the areas investigating Pug Whitaker and Enron? DynCorp. So even though the Department of Justice and the SEC did not assert control over the documents of Enron, it would appear that the chairman of the Finance Committee had asserted, you know, control over the documents of the SEC and the Department of Justice.
Now, there've got to be some good players in all of this somewhere. Good investigators, good law enforcement people who are frustrated and trying to get to the bottom of this?
Well, let's talk about the real problem. Let's say tomorrow you became the President of the United States.
All right.
Okay? What does everybody in America want from you, President George?
Truth.
No, they want their check.
Well, no, I would hope they want the truth first.
I was a government official. They all have mortgages to pay or debt service to pay. They want their check. And to get their check, you have to borrow more money. And it turns out you have to borrow more money from a variety of people around the world who also have significant investments in the banks and the contractors who run your information and accounting systems.
So we're doomed.
No, we're not doomed. In fact, there is a way out. But for the President of the United States to push the red button, 73,000 neighborhoods have to push the red button. In other words, the American people have to want to what I call turn the red button green, which is they have to be prepared to re-engineer how the money works in their neighborhood and do it in a way that provides for the basic needs of both people and governments, you know, and governance resources. In other words, we can't, it's just like if you're a farmer, you can't eat more than you grow forever. And so the day that we decide we want to grow up and we want to stop acting like financial children and we're willing to grow more than we eat and we're willing to change, then if 73,000 neighborhoods can push the red button, the president can too.
Getting back to 9/11, which is, I think, part of the reason why you believe some of this fraud has now occurred even more than it is, and I assume you think that it possibly was a cover-up to hide some things. Is that true?
Well, I think to get the Air Force to stand down four times, you know, I don't think, you know, Looney Tunes, Islamic, you know, whatever, can get that to happen.
Now, there was an old operation, codename called Northwoods,
uh-huh.
which is real, which is out there, that had that parts of government were to fake terror attacks on its own citizens.
Right.
It was created a long, long time ago. Let's assume for just a moment that a plan like that was decided. Tell me, in a closed-door room, before it happened, why would they want this to occur? What would they be saying to each other, whoever they may be?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know who did it. I don't know how it came down, but let me approach it.
But you do believe it was done on purpose.
I believe that the people who did it were choosing between a series of options, and I would be prepared to defend in a court of law. I'm not an attorney, but if I was, the people who did it, to the extent that they took the position, they did what they thought was the best thing for everybody. In other words, let's say that you are the leader and you say, look, if we don't lock up the oil resources worldwide now,
we're in trouble.
We're in trouble, and we're in trouble for a variety of reasons related to, you know, if you look at the weaponry now existing, if we don't do it, the other guys will.
We've got an advantage now. Let's take advantage of it.
Right. So we're in a prisoner's dilemma. If we don't do it, the other guys will do it and kill us. So we decide, you know, because we have the power, we have the technology, that, you know, in this game, the conservative strategy is to go for control now. Okay, so, you know, we do it, and we can't, we think, we can't get the United States to move to a permanent war economy. And we think a permanent war economy is essential if we and our families and friends are going to be successful. So we say, okay, well, here's the way to persuade them. Let's have 9/11.
And
let's let it happen in purpose.
Or let's just turn our heads and let it happen.
Well, but let me be the bad guy here. I would submit, and this is, you know, I'm guessing, George, but
hold on now. This is way too deep to guess.
Well, you know, you have to work it. We all work. Every human being works with what's available to them. I mean, you and I make assumptions.
Why don't we just say this is your opinion?
Oh, okay. It's my opinion.
All right.
It's my opinion. I think the people who did 9/11 have been politically and economically fantastically successful as a result. I think it was to date, you know, if we end it right here, this was the single most successful act of piracy in the history of the planet. And I think what they would tell you is their strategy has been phenomenally successful. It worked. And its success has proved that strategies like that work.
What if you wanted to get your house painted and you just couldn't come up with a reason to do it?
Uh-huh.
But you knew if you invited some people over, some kids, that, you know, they might put their little smudgy hands on the wall and stuff. And then you'd have a great excuse to go to your husband and say, you know what, now we got to paint the house.
Uh-huh.
And he says, yeah, you're right, the place is now a mess, go ahead and do it. Had the event not occur, had the kids not come over with their smudgy little hands, you never would have had the house painted.
Right.
Maybe it's also possible that whatever was going to happen was well known, was documented, we were forewarned, But these same people that you're talking about who have profited, who have pirated, simply said, let's just look the other way, because this is the excuse we've been waiting for. Possible?
Well, anything's possible. I just think it's very hard to get the Air Force to stand down four times. I mean, to me, the biggest unanswered question is, how in the world do you get the Air Force to stand down four times? That's a pretty phenomenal achievement.
I guess you could say stupidity, incompetence, but our Air Force is not that.
Well, I'll tell you a very interesting story. I was at a Precious Metals conference in New Orleans in November, and George Tenet was speaking. And he invited questions from the audience, so I got up and I said, Mr. Tenet, my name is Catherine Austin Fitz. Can you explain how the Air Force stood down four times on 9/11? And he kind of turned bright red, didn't answer for about 10 or 15 seconds, and then he said, he'd been speaking, George, about the importance of coordination between military and intelligence, why we needed the new bill. And he said, well, my dear, I ran the CIA. I wouldn't know. You'd have to ask the Air Force. You know, and his tone of voice impressed me as a man who was very scared.
Well, so he did resign.
That is a very significant unanswered question.
He did resign. Stay with us, Catherine. I had heard that tremendous amounts of drug money, that it's propping up the stock market. Is this true?
Well, I think organized crime money and drug money is a relatively small part of it compared to financial fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Is absolutely propping up all the capital markets. I'm part of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, which has illuminated a lot about the manipulation of the gold markets. A very frightening part. We believe the price of gold has been suppressed significantly, while gold has been moved out of the inventories of central banks and governments into private hands. It's what I call piratization. When you move assets out of government, at below market prices,
right,
it's tremendous windfalls to private parties.
That's interesting.
And so I absolutely think that organized crime monies has been used to do this in a way which is to all of our disadvantages and to the advantages of a relatively small handful of parties. It's part of centralizing the economy. The drug trade, George, is extremely important to the political control of neighborhoods. You know, when I was on Wall Street in Washington, I kept saying, you know, why is everybody making such a big deal out of drugs? In terms of total organized crime, or in terms of total dirty money, it's really a relatively small part, because financial fraud has become so big. But when you drive around the country and you start to understand the damage that it does, and the ease with which it improves the ability of the big companies to move in and take over market share away from small business. I mean, drugs have been very devastating for small business and small farmers and citizens in general and families, because what makes for a strong democratic nation is strong families. It starts with strong families.
What is the end result here, the picture? What's going on? Because there is a method here behind
their
madness.
What's going on, George? I was part of a group of people in the 90s who put forward a policy and said, globalization means we're moving jobs abroad. We need to re-engineer skills. We need to flow equity capital to small business. And we need the American people to kind of jump the curve on globalization so that we remain a strong, middle-class, democratic nation. A plan was put into place, and I've documented it with stories at my website. You can read them. That said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to move the jobs abroad. We're simply going to bubble the economy with a housing bubble and a consumer debt bubble and government debt. As we bubble the economy, we're going to suck huge amounts of money out of government and out of the stock market and pension funds. That money, you know, could some of that money have been used to finance the black budget and covert operations? Certainly. But that money was also used by the players to buy up sort of the properties on the monopoly board in the overt world as well. And my fear is that money is now going to come back in a situation where the middle class is gentrified out of existence in America, and our constitutional way of government is going to be essentially destroyed by what is in essence a financial coup d'etat.
Well, this sounds like a globalist's agenda.
I believe it is a globalist agenda, because if you look at the management of the financial system, it's become extremely extremely centralized. So in part it's a globalist agenda, but many of the people who've been engaging in these activities are far from globalists. So is there a globalist agenda? Certainly.
Who's going to burst the bubble? It'll continue going
well,
on and on.
Well, that's the question. You know, for many, many years, George, I've thought, oh, my God. You know, right before 9/11, From the Wilderness put out an economic alert saying the global financial market is in a meltdown. And every time many of us have thought, oh, my God, we're going to hit the depression, the markets are going to melt down.
Something happens.
We have 9/11. We have a war in Iraq. Essentially, we have these huge catastrophic events that then sort of, you know, reassert the central control and kind of pull the thing out financially.
Or how about divert our attention as well?
Absolutely, divert our attention. And my fear is what's happening is we won't get a crash. We will simply continue to watch more and more powerful political and covert agendas be able to exercise more and more control of the economy so that financial assets can continue to be subsidized by basically by war and killing, by stealing, you know, whether it's killing trees or killing dolphins or killing people. We are subsidizing the financial markets and a small handful of people by destroying the planet. It's very frightening.
Do you believe that there's evil on this planet, Catherine, and that we need to eradicate it?
It's so funny. In 1998, I was explaining my vision of how to solve this, you know, the Solari model, to a group of people, mm-hmm. including a very high-level person at the CIA, who looked at me with complete disgust and said, "Your problem is you don't understand where evil comes from." And, you know, I have to laugh because I, as ashamed as I am to admit it, I still don't believe I know where evil comes from. And, you know, and I think that is the unanswered question of our day. Who's doing this? Why are they doing it? And where does evil come from? I've seen great evil in my life, you know, but I've seen it in all groups, all places, all things. And the question is why? We are a very primitive culture, and the question is why?
Are you scared, personally or otherwise?
No.
You're not?
No.
I mean, you're saying some pretty deep
things. Well, I'm kind of ashamed to admit that I don't know. You know, I've worked my whole life to understand what's happening and why.
You don't look over your shoulder when you're walking down the street?
No. I grew up in West Philadelphia, in the streets of West Philadelphia. I used to always look over my shoulder when I was a kid.
Oh, but these boys are a little tougher than that.
Well, what happened to me, I went through some terrifying physical harassment and surveillance. And I had a wonderful church, George, in Washington, and their core competency was spiritual warfare. And I really got to a very divine place about the whole thing. I thought on several occasions I was sure I would not live the night. You know, people breaking in the house one time, my heart stopped. You know, it's a long story. But what happened is you arrive at a place where you feel like you're resurrected. And every day it's a gift. And so, you know, you kind of go into a whole new state of flow. The other thing is, I have found there's certain things people can do that cause problems, and then there are other things that don't. And what I've tried to do with all my public speaking and, you know, even on my litigation is rather than try and blame this person or that person, explain the system, because I've never known, and I've known some very rich and powerful people and worked with them in my life, particularly when I was on Wall Street, George.
And were they nice people?
Yes. I've seen as much, if not more, enlightenment at the top than I have at the bottom.
Well,
but
I mean,
I've never met a person, George, who didn't feel like they were a prisoner of the system.
Really?
In other words, you know, some of the people I felt the most sad for were the people at the top. I mean, I've been a government official, and I can tell you I had every kind of person, north, south, east, west, male, female, old, young, black, white, come into me, and what they all wanted was a free lunch.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume that you know for sure, and I don't want the names right now because, you know, I don't have them on, whoever they may be, and I can't challenge them on this. So, but let's assume you know who all the individuals are involved in all these activities. Have you met them personally?
Some of them, sure.
I mean, what do they, when you look at their eyes, I'm curious, what do they look like? I mean, do they act normal? Do they have this look of the devil?
No, the people who engage, in my experience, in the most corrupt activities, you know, and it's hard to generalize, but they act kind of, you know, drunk with power in a way that I can only describe as demonic and lost.
Do you want to, like, get away from them?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I worked for Jack Kemp, and I could tell you some amazing Jack Kemp stories. You know, but Jack Kemp would go into what I can only describe as psychotic episodes. And, you know, I would watch him do, I can tell you many, you know, Jack Kemp.
Well, I don't care about Jack Kemp stories, to tell you
well,
the truth. And the guy's not here to defend himself.
Right, but here's my guess as to what I saw. What I saw was a politician who was subject to pressures which no human being should have to be subject to, who was subject to threats and blackmail. You know, I watched somebody who was very, very afraid. And so you know, what I came to believe was we were in a system where rising further in power required going along with, you know, going along with the process of governing
with the program
that was way outside the law.
Or the people you care about are gone.
Right.
I mean, you know, it wouldn't scare me if someone threatened me, and I have been. But what would bother me is if somebody wanted to start screwing around with my family.
And they do.
Yeah.
You know, I believe they do. So, you know, I think we live in a very violent culture, and the governance of resources, we have not found a peaceful way to manage resources.
How long has this been going on? Since 19 what?
Well, I think it's been going on for all of the recorded history that I've studied, but I think certainly for the last 500 years, the Western economies have had an economic model of central banking and warfare where we depend, it's what I call a negative return on investment economy, we depend on war and covert intervention to subsidize the economic model.
I think this has been going on
for very long, and we've had a period where, you know, we've had a middle class in America who's been protected from it. At the same time that we've been protected from it, new technology has allowed a much more kind of venal strain of what's going on.
Can any elected official stop it?
Well, let me tell you what can stop it. If 281 million Americans tomorrow got up and said, I'm going to vote with my resources, I mean, I don't just vote at the polls every year or two. I vote in the marketplace every day with my money, and I'm not going to bank or deposit or use credit cards from a bank who's complicit in, you know, $4 trillion being stolen from the U.S. government. I mean,
it's not going to happen, Catherine, because that's not realistic. You know, you have some guy on Saturday night wants to take his date out. He drives up to his ATM and takes out some money.
Why can't he switch to a local bank?
It's probably more convenient to have these banks all over the place, these big ones.
Well, no, I bank at Farmers and Merchants Bank in Bolivar, Tennessee, and I have an ATM card and can get money anywhere.
And really, what's the difference with a local bank? Aren't they all in the same game?
Well, I think when you have 25,000 bank presidents competing, you know, for attention and political power, it's a lot. You know, diversification is good. So, yeah, I think it makes a huge difference if you diversify. And there are other systems too. So, but I'm not saying vote with your resources to inconvenience yourself. I'm saying vote with your resources. I mean, for example, why are people buying the New York Times when they could be listening to your radio show?
Well, they do listen to my radio show.
Right,
we've got 10 million listeners.
Right,
which is probably a bigger circulation than the New York Times.
Oh yeah, no, but if you look at how much money we're putting in the pockets of media that's not telling us the truth. Banks that are acting against our best interest, you know, donating to not-for-profits who have endowments that are acting against our best interest. We have phenomenal power voting with our money or simply expressing an opinion as a consumer or investor in those organizations we're participating in. We can do it passively or we can do it actively. But what we need to do as the world privatizes and all this, you know, this resource control. I mean, if government's going to be run by corporations, then the time has come when we need to integrate our consumer vote with our political vote, because it's now one vote.
Tell me why the price of gasoline is more now than when before we went into Iraq, when we weren't taking over that oil. Now, I don't know how much barrelage they're pumping out of Iraq, but I know it's not going to Saddam Hussein anymore.
It's an excellent question, and George, I honestly don't know the answer. It is a highly, in my opinion, manipulated market.
I agree.
And the reality is that for 100 years that we all know of, the suppression of other energy technology, which is far cheaper, we've done everything in the last 10 years with the housing and transportation policies in this country to increase our dependency on fossil fuel, when tremendous technologies and, you know, existed which could have phenomenally decreased
we could have been using oil for plastics and some other things that I think you need to use it for, and gotten away from this reliance on anything. I mean,
right, home building could have been different, traffic patterns, so
political things could have been different. We wouldn't have to be fighting other nations to take over some of these resources.
Right, and so I think the question is, why have we suppressed this technology? You know, the price of oil has been determined politically, whether it's because of 100 years of suppression of technology, you know, and government support of doing it, or, you know, there's a shortage of fossil fuel, however you want to explain it. But it reflects a political problem, which is a symptom, just like all the other symptoms we've been discussing, which is the money's not being run to optimize, you know, a peaceful economy and an abundant, wealthy world. We are destroying, essentially, to look at the thing whole and speak as an investment banker, we are shrinking total wealth so that we can centralize total wealth. And in the process, we are damaging, you know, our water, we're destroying the planet environmentally and the quality of life for our children and grandchildren. And that's the question, why? Because it is literally a demonic process.
Well, this is going to be a tough hill to climb.
Yeah, but you know something? It all starts. I used to have a wonderful pastor who said, "If we can face it, God can fix it." No one person has to take a lot of risk to change this. I was a government official. There are many wonderful government officials, state, local, federal government, who could start to change this if they had popular support to look at it and deal with it. I mean, the problem was, if you were an honest government official, the crowd voted for the dirty guy, not for you. You know, but if there is enough of a grassroots groundswell from people who are willing to vote with their money and express these opinions, and that's why your show is so important. You know, there are people who are paid to change this. And what I say again is, you know, there are a lot of government officials who can push the red button if the crowd will support them, but right now the crowd doesn't support them.
I know the new Secretary of HUD, Alfonso Jackson.
Uh-huh.
And because he was, you know, in St. Louis for a long time, he was contemplating running for mayor years ago and had asked my help for that. Nice guy, good guy.
Uh-huh.
And I would guess totally, totally unfamiliar with some of the things you've said.
Wouldn't surprise me, because when I saw our team get to HUD, we had no idea what we were walking into. We had no idea.
And it must be huge.
I think, you know, the funny thing is, I've run companies, George, and without tight financials and a tight process where your banker or the SEC will shut off your money if you don't behave, you know, it's very hard to ensure cleanliness and discipline. So if you've got the most powerful nation in the world and there's no
controls,
there's no process that insists on accountability and transparency, and you literally are in a process where, you know, the guy who's the Secretary of HUD, if he says no, he's not safe.
What would happen? Would it be un-American if all of us, refused to pay taxes in 1 year and said, folks, clean up your house first or we're not paying you anymore?
Well, I have an article called The Solari Solution on just this topic.
Well, let's talk about that when we come back.
Okay.
Also phone calls, because you're ready for everything?
Okay.
We'll do it. We will hold nothing back. So I guess if they weren't siphoning off all this money, Catherine, Social Security would be in pretty good shape, wouldn't it?
It would certainly be in much better shape.
Man, let me tell you something.
I was so happy to hear your numbers about the New York Times.
Yeah.
That's why I'm an optimist. I mean, I have to tell you, I think the American people are the most generous, decent, wonderful people in the world. And the fact that they're voting with their money and their time for you and not the New York Times is enormously makes me feel much better.
there's hope, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely, there's hope.
Do you think that Europeans would like to see our system of government, the one we perceive, to totally collapse?
Oh, not at all.
Really?
Not at all. In the last 2 years, I've been in London, I've been in Sweden, I've been, you know, it's phenomenal how popular America and the notion of American democracy and sort of a country where the little guy has a chance, how popular that is with most Europeans. I'm always amazed. And they have a marvelous, you know, sort of feeling about the American people and you know, the American opportunity. And I think seeing America go the way it's going is not what they want at all. Now, I think there's a lot of European investment that has traditionally, been at odds with sort of American political interest, you know, or local self-sufficiency.
But, you know, I don't want you to rule out the globalists, because I do believe that they have a bigger plan for some kind of global government.
Oh, I agree with you. I think that's true.
Let's go to the calls. True. You ready?
Oh, absolutely. Let's go.
Here they come. Let's go to our wild card line. First of all, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Queens, New York.
Well, welcome to the show.
Catherine and George, I have the holy grail of what you're looking for.
What do you have?
I have worked 4 years now with the 911 families, and we did tireless hundreds and hundreds of hours of research. What came up, and George, you're not going to be too happy with this. Admiral Fry, who is in the United States Navy, changed the directive June 1st, 2001, and it's on their website, that only Donald Rumsfeld could give orders to the commanders to respond in 9/11. Also, all along, they have denied that they were wargaming that.
Well, day. Hold on. He did that on June 1st, 2001?
June 1st, 2001. Also, NORAD.
Well, wait a minute. No, let me ask you something.
Go ahead.
He did not put into that directive any wording about 9/11, did he?
He did not say it, but he said, this is what he said, quote, in case of a hijacking, all commanders are stripped of the responsibility to proceed without the consent of Donald Rumsfeld first. The same day, June 1st, okay, NORAD had on their magazine four planes with bin Laden in the middle. So this was well planned beforehand. When I went to the 911 hearing in New York, the Port Authority and Giuliani confirmed that they were briefed July 1st with FEMA that there was going to be an attack on the Pentagon. Also, I met Mike Rubit and Representative Cynthia McClinley at another hearing where they were told that Dick Cheney was working with P-TECH. This is very, very important. You could confirm this with Mike Rupert, that P-TECH had changed the software where that day the air traffic controller saw 22 false positives, and they didn't know whether it was real or not. Now, all along, the White House has denied that there was any war game until March 23rd, 2005, where Cynthia McClinley confronted Donald Rumsfeld and Myers and said, I want to know, were you war gaming that day? And they looked at each other and they said, we have to tell the truth. And they said, yes, we were war gaming five games. We were in control of this.
Yeah, that is true.
All right. Now, also, Senator Grassley called. I wrote a letter. And I have
okay, well, did you have a question, though? Because we've got so many people calling.
I'm saying to you, this goes right into the White House. When I gave Tim Romer, I want to know when you give this information out that this was an inside job about, and like Catherine said, the most important thing is why the Air Force fell. Does this information help out? Because I could email her this.
Do you want this information, Catherine?
I have it. I think it's very useful and important information. I appreciate it.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Appreciate your call, Arlene. Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello.
Yes, it's Chad.
Hi, Chad. Go ahead.
It's Chad. I wanted to answer a question of who these people might be, and I think it traces back to some of the original power families that come out of Europe, such as the Astors, the Bundys, Collins family, the DuPont family, the Freemans, even some contingencies in the Kennedys. In China, you have the Li family, L-I. You have the Onassis family, the Rothschilds, the Russell family, Rockefellers, the Merovingian family, and the Van Dynes. And if you trace everything back, and there's a significant connection to the Federal Reserve and how the money moves, you'll still find a lot of the money power structure still being run the way it used to be centuries ago, perhaps even thousands of years ago, by this people, these contingencies who believe that they have divine right.
Well, these are the globalists.
Exactly.
The Illuminati.
Exactly. And I believe there's concentric circles of these globalists, whether it's Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR, the Trilateral Commission, Skull and Bones, contingencies within the Vatican, within the intelligence community. I've been told by my friends in the intelligence community that the CIA has tremendous overlap with Israeli Mossad, British Secret Service, Russian intelligence. Wherever you find money and power, I think you'll agree that there's tremendous corruption.
Well, first of all, though, I think the intelligence worldwide needs to be intertwined, so I don't think there's anything unusual about that. The bigger thrust of the story is who would these people be? Who is the Illuminati? What do they want? What do they want to attain? I think the bottom line here, Catherine, is, and you haven't touched on this yet, but when it all has to do with money and control, I also think it's population control. You know, as you read 6 billion people on this planet, and we all read the same things where they think our resources are dwindling. I'm not necessarily sure that's the case, but that's what they say. Then you would think that their agenda would be to preserve this planet for themselves and their 500 million other friends. Very possible.
Well, this algebraically, we tried to simulate the economy when I was doing the software development that I described, and what we came up with was essentially, if we kept on the current trajectory, we'd have to depopulate by a significant amount, or we could do what I call the Solari model, which is re-engineer to a much more productive economy and a much more lawful economy. I mean, you can't stand this kind of corruption and environmental destruction. So, I mean, there is a way the population, I believe, can support the current population, in a state of with no poverty. I mean, we have the economic and technological basis to have a wonderful life with no poverty, but that's a significant political change. And the question is it possible and how can you do it?
And do they really want to?
Yeah, I think it's a bigger, I think it's a bigger week because you're talking about a significant spiritual change. We are going through a process where we have amazing technology and, what's coming out of the black budget is just amazing technology. But we don't have a culture which can, it's a little bit like giving laser guns to the Neanderthal men.
Yeah.
So we don't have a culture that is intellectually and spiritually evolved and socially evolved to handle this kind of powerful technology.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Where are you calling from?
This is Roy from Harrisburg, PA.
Okay, Roy. It's all yours.
Well, I'm on the road, so I didn't catch what Catherine's background is.
Well, I grew up in Philly.
Oh, there you go.
I grew up on the streets of Philadelphia, and my neighborhood was destroyed by HUD fraud and drugs, which is how I got interested in all of this. But I grew up in Philly. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, studied in Hong Kong, and then went to Wall Street.
had a successful career on Wall Street, lived in New York, and then went to Washington to be assistant secretary. And then 4 years ago, when I was the enemy of state, went on the road living in four places on an unpredictable schedule, but settled in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, which is where I now live. But I'm a Philly girl, and I used to be financial advisor to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, so I've been to Harrisburg many times.
Okay. Actually, I was born near Philly, too.
Oh, really?
The question I have is, with all this corruption, I was wondering how much you, and it's been a known fact that money has been taken from Social Security, how much corruption do you think there is in the Social Security money? And then
I don't think there is any money in the Social Security fund. I think there's just a bunch of securities saying I owe you from the Treasury. I think the plan to privatize Social Security is one of the most frightening, dangerous things I've ever seen, because if you think they can, if you think they can lower their cost of capital to the inside players through the kind of mechanisms we've been talking about now, when they can overtly borrow money with the U.S. Treasury securities and use it to, fuel the stock market through Social Security, that's when the inside players just literally blow the rest of small business away. So I think privatization of Social Security as it's being planned is the death of small business remaining in this country.
Well, I agree 100%, and one of the things that I think that's going to happen, and you were saying there's hope, I don't believe in hope. I think they won and we lost, because what they did was they brought us into the circle. There are more and more people who are invested financially into this corporate menagerie, and we're stuck. We can't get out. And this whole privatization of Social Security will just be one more notch that they can add to it.
Well, I do think we can get out, because if you study what's happening, this centralization is destroying wealth. And in fact, a decentralizing process, which this technology is natural to do, creates far more wealth. So it's very possible that what I call the pro-centralization team can create far more wealth than the pro-centralization team, and in that lies tremendous hope. One of the things I really hope to communicate tonight is so much money is being wasted in the current system that there is a possibility to unleash tremendous wealth by turning this around. You can turn the red button green, but
back
you can't
off the
do
old
it
phone.
Face things.
All right, back off the old phone again. What kind of phone are you using, by the way?
Pardon me?
What kind of phone are you using?
It's a GE Pro Series business telephone.
I'm going to have to write a little note to GE. I'll take care of that. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good.
George, I wanted to ask you two questions. Or shall I say, I want to ask Catherine two questions.
Sure.
This is Michael from Orlando, Florida, by the way.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. I want to ask the question about the Bush-Clinton crime family, particularly as it alluded to drug smuggling. You talked about that a little bit, but then you backed away from it. Could you tell me a little more about that?
Yeah, what I've tried to understand and study is the traffic patterns in MENA, Arkansas, as a way of kind of getting a sense of what happened during Iran-Contra.
Right.
And if you're interested in that, I'd really recommend you read Sam Smith's Progressive Review and Mike Rupert's website.
Oh, yeah, it's on Michael Rupert's website, and it's on Stuart Webb's website. Stuart Webb talks about there being a DEA videotape of George and Jeb Bush flying drugs in from Miami.
I've never seen it.
Yeah.
I've never seen it. But
yeah, that's on the Stuart
Webb
website.
I finally drove over to MENA, over to Arkansas and met with Mark Swaney, who did a lot of the research on the money laundering through the HUD agency there. Anyway, so I've read a lot and studied a lot and am persuaded that there was a significant arms narcotics trafficking operation that had the political involvement of both sides. Now, it depends on who you read and what you say to guess what's true, but it's clear that there is, significant narcotics trafficking in this country. It can't possibly work at this level without tremendous, political support at a governmental level.
But there have never been any charges leveled against any of these individuals he just mentioned.
Correct. Absolutely. mean, there's simply been books and stories and, you know, various allegations.
Yeah, and allegations, aren't enough foundation. Next up, Wildcard Line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, man. My name's Danny. I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia.
Hi, Danny.
Yeah, I was going to call and see if Catherine could give me any advice on property taxes.
Uh-huh.
How so?
In 2003, our property tax went from 52 cents per every $100 of value. And this, in 2004, we didn't even see, we had no notices of it being increased, and went to $1.08. And I was looking into the county papers in the very back, and it shows that we paid $14 million in property taxes in our county, which is a very small suburb county. And we got Richmond City and other counties around us that are paying like 80 cents per $100 of their value. And we're losing funds, we're losing services, businesses are going out, and drugs are running rampant in our community.
Right. It sounds, I live in Hardeman County, Tennessee. It's the same pattern. My reports that I get from around the country is there are steady increases in property taxes in many places. My recommendation to you, if you have the interest and you have friends or associates who are interested, is if you start to dig in and really study the federal, state, and local resources in your place, you know, if you collect up the budgets and start looking and start asking where money's going, what you will find is that there is significant opportunity to re-engineer how money works to work back to your advantage. And I would really encourage you to do that.
You know, you can appeal if your property taxes go up, but I don't know how many people are successful that way, Catherine.
Well, generally I find if you try and work just within the particular system that you're in by yourself, it won't work. If you dig in, let me give you an example. In 1996, an old partner of mine from Wall Street came down to my company in Washington, and I demoed Community Wizard. And he said to me, well, this is a totally stupid idea. It's totally hopeless. There's nothing you can do. And I said, well, Luis, what neighborhood do you live in? And he said, I live in Bronxville, New York. So I said to somebody, print out our list of all the federal expenditures in Bronxville, New York. And I turned the list over to Luis, and within 2 seconds, he was Cuban. He started screaming in Spanish about all the corruption. And I said, what's the matter? And he says, $4 million in flood insurance. This is so corrupt. I said, well, why is that corrupt? It doesn't sound corrupt to me. And he said, Bronxville's on a hill. There hasn't been a flood in 30 years. So the next day, he flew back to New York. I was supposed to be on a conference call with him. I couldn't get through. It was busy for hours. And finally, I said, Luis, you know, I got through. And I said, where have you been? And he said, I have been on the phone with the deputy mayor of Bronxville for the last 3.5 hours, going through this line item by line item. He said, all this waste and corruption is going to stop right now. And I said, Luis, I thought you said it was hopeless. And he said, that's before I had the numbers.
We'll be back in a moment with our guest, Catherine Austin Fitz. Her website is solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I. Remember that old song from a long time ago called Buttons and Bows, Catherine?
No.
It goes, you've heard it. It goes, the rich get rich and the poor get poor. And it goes on and on and on.
Oh, yeah, okay.
All right. How true, huh?
Yes, true. Yes, true.
Are they taking advantage of us to do it?
I would say so, yes. I would say so, but the challenge is, you know, why do we let them?
Well, first of all, how many people know that they're even doing it until you start talking about it or programs like this start talking about it?
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the reasons it happens is because we really, you know, I call it the tapeworm.
Yuck.
Know, it's like a parasite in our midst. It's an economy where a few inside players can take advantage. And I think tapeworms operate because, one, we don't know we have a tapeworm. We can't see it. You know, who is it? How does it work? But the other is the way a tapeworm functions in your body is it ejects a chemical into you that makes you crave what the tapeworm wants. And I think if you look at how modern media has been built and developed, you know, we have tremendous programming in our educational systems and in our media that encourage us to want what's good for the tapeworm.
Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Where might you be? Hi there.
Well, I'm in Washington, D.C. My name is Tom.
Hi, Tom. Listening to us on WMAL, I take it.
Yes.
Okay. Welcome. Good to have you with us. Are you in the government somewhere?
I used to work with the government, yes, and I've actually had dinner with Catherine at the McLennan Group. I was headed for Iraq, or at least I thought I was, and she strongly advised me against that in telecommunications. And I think that although I wouldn't quite go so far as to say she saved my life, it not going to Iraq may well have saved my life. So thank you, Catherine.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Question. Actually, two questions. One is regarding resource scarcities and abundance, but the first question regarding Iraq and regarding what you say you don't know about why oil is higher now than it was before, given that the oil exports from Iraq are less now than they were before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and given that $10 billion of the $12 billion for reconstruction of the infrastructure of Iraq is unspent at this time, and given that the U.S. Viceroy, essentially Viceroy for Iraq, Bremer, fired 400,000 Iraqi troops as his first move when he came into office in Iraq, who immediately then became desperate men with guns and no money, do you think that the political and military chaos currently occurring in Iraq is a deliberate policy objective as part of the tapeworm strategy that you so brilliantly outline on your website and in your articles?
Well, it could be. My biggest concern about Iraq is I think it's very hard to get reliable intelligence on what's really happening.
Well, I got some. Working with the groups that I'm working with, some of which are in government, I get the good stuff out of there from people on the ground, both government and non-government, as well as Dar Jamil and other people who are on the ground over there. And so, you know, if you need to know anything about what's going on there, I may be able to give you what you need.
Here's my concern as to what may be happening. And there's a wonderful book by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave called The Gold Warriors that describes how the booty at the end of World War II in Asia was sort of whacked up among private parties so the taxpayer pays, the citizens in the country die, and then private guys run off with the money. My fear is that the corruption has become so extraordinary that the system is breaking down.
Absolutely.
And it's breaking down in a way that puts our troops at terrible, terrible danger,
and
let alone the harm
too
being done to Iraq. So, you know, my concern is that we're looking at a very inefficient corruption, which makes it that much more dangerous to many,
correct,
many innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right. What was your other question?
The other question is, do you believe that Buckminster Fuller was right about the abundance of resources on the planet, and that scarcities are only contrived to politically manipulate the people of this planet all the way down to the level of the communities that you described?
Well, I'm much more sympathetic to the guys in the top than Bucky Fuller, but Bucky Fuller, he wrote a wonderful book called The Grunch.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, I read it and I said, why didn't I read this book 10 years earlier? It could have saved me $6 million. But it's quite, you know, Fuller figured out incredible stuff. And I think the question that Fuller brought to the fore is the most important one. How can we create a culture where we think in abundant ways, where I believe that if I help bless you, that will help bless me? You know, how do we come up with a win-win culture? And that's a critical question. Bucky did tremendous work on that.
The opposite of that, though, appears to be the peak oil theory that your friend Mike is putting forward. Mike Rupert's putting forward, and that the supposed scarcity of resources that the recent reports, including the CIA reports, are touting, which I believe and others believe, are being used deliberately and contrived to put, politically manipulate the people of the United States as well as other nations. What's your call on that?
Well, but I think what Mike is saying is, you know, manipulate, the scarcity may be manipulated, but it's going to be like a train that runs over us either way. So whether it's politically induced or it's resource induced, the average citizen needs to protect themselves from the dynamic.
See, I would believe with Tom, the caller, that a lot of this is induced for,
right,
you know, their own reasons. Let's go to our Tom. Thanks for your call. International Line, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, I'm Denise. I'm calling from Mexico.
Hello, Denise.
Hi, and thank you so much for taking the call, Catherine. And George, I always learn so much on your program. Catherine, this is really playing into a lot of things that I had reason to believe were going on. But I did have a question bothered me when I first heard about them, and that's about reverse mortgages.
Uh-huh.
And I thought when I heard it that that was something that might be used to strip retired or people who were older and had less opportunity to actually continue owning their own property for keeping it, and might be a way for someone else to come in and buy it out from under them.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think our economy is being run. If you took the, I used to have a member of the Solari Action Network who for the last 4 years took the BEA, Bureau of Economic Analysis Statistics, and his configuration said that the average American household had a deficit. In other words, they spent more in just daily expenses than they had revenues of about $5,000, and they were financing that drain by borrowing more money, you know, particularly against their house. That's what this housing bubble is. The famous quote, you know, they've turned our homes into ATM machines.
Okay.
And so you'll see a lot of older people borrowing more and more money just to survive and to live. And that's a concern because, oddly enough, the amount of household deficit that we have on average is the same amount which is going to the government in taxes, that portion that's going to agencies that don't produce audited financial statements. And grossly oversimplifying, we are losing the equity in our homes because our money's going down the black budget. And that's why I think, you know, the question of what is the black budget, you know, how does it work, and how do we do something about it is such an important one, because we're all getting financially drained. Walk around America, everybody's, I haven't been to Mexico for many years, but everybody here is tired. Now, I take that back. I was in Mexico in Cancun and 6 months ago, but you know, I think there's a financial drain, and that's turning into sort of a physical and emotional drain, and that's part of what's causing everybody's debt to go up. And the easier it is to borrow money out of our homes, you know, that's helping to facilitate the drain. So I think your concern is a very valid one,
and I do appreciate the fact that not only are you highlighting the troublesome truth, but also are offering some concrete solutions to that, which is always found wanting. A lot of the times we hear about all the problems and the troubles, but never some concrete ideas to how to work with it. With regard to switching to a local bank, does a credit union, would that work as well as a local bank, or is that a totally different type of?
No, a credit union could work well. I think the most important thing that I could communicate is, you know, I kind of believe in the paradigm of the good guys and bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Where are the best management, you know, where are people of integrity who are competent? If you can find a local financial institution where you have excellent people governing on the board, excellent people managing it, excellent people involved in advisory, you know, because what I call them the community wizards, they're the people who really make things go in a community.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do is stop backing the people at the top, you know, who are doing, you want to stop backing people who are complicit or allowing criminality or haven't stopped it, and start backing the community wizards. So I would tend to choose not it's a credit union versus a community bank, but where is the local financial institution that really has excellent leadership that you want to support and back.
All right, thanks for that call. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, my name's John, and I'm from Grants Pass, Oregon.
Know it well, John. Go ahead.
It's a real honor to talk to both of you folks tonight. George, I've been listening for over 15 years, and this has got to be one of the most insightful programs I've ever heard.
Thank you.
I have two quick questions for you, and I'll take the answers off the air. The first one is, if 911 is the end result of a snowball effect, what's next? And then, George, you had a guest on your program talking about the Fed, and basically saying that the dollar is printed and kept in circulation because of the confidence in the dollar, and that there's a fear that China may convert to the euro. And if China does convert to the euro, what does this do to this whole scheme? Thank you much.
And that was Andre Aglesian, who was our guest when he talked about the Federal Reserve. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, I think if China converts to the euro, the dollar's in for a very bad fall. I mean, right now, the two of the most significant holders are China and Japan. So if we, and we see the Chinese currency tied to the U.S. currency, so, for example, If you're shopping at Walmart or a company, you know, some of the big stores, that the low prices reflect that tying of the Chinese dollar, and so much of the manufacturing, George, is going on in China. So you delink those two, and you could see not only our revenues and incomes continue to fall, but suddenly our expenses skyrocket.
What if we switch to the euro?
Well, I've just been doing a teleseminar called Investing in Silver and Gold. I mean, there is a global currency. There has been for 2,000 years. It's called silver and gold. And so one of the things I do, I'm a user of digital gold and gold currency systems. And so at the end of the Great Depression, there were 3,000 community currencies in America. And so there's lots of alternatives, whether it's precious metals or community currencies, to start to really get out of the dollar. And I think it's a matter of sound financial practice to start, you know, looking into those and seeing what might work for you. Because, George, let's say you have $1,000 in your checking account on average this year. If the dollar falls a lot, you know, in the last year you've lost about 30% of your purchasing power just letting it sit in the bank.
30%. Amazing.
Yeah, and if it had sat in silver and gold during that same period, lost that 30%.
No, believe me, I got a client who keeps screaming at me, more gold, more gold. Wildcard Line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello. This is Ted calling from Sherman Oaks.
Hi, Ted. How are you?
Good. Yeah, this is one of the best guests that I've heard. Catherine, you're just very, very intelligent, very beautiful person.
Oh, thanks, Ted.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is that I do think that the globalist, if you want to call it that, group, there's a very spiritual aspect to that, and there's something that I noticed, actually because of something that William Cooper said on one of his tapes about September 11th, and this was in 96. There's actually a point about that date where it works out as actually the first day of the new millennium, if you go back to the Coptic calendar, which is actually sort of an intersection between Egyptian and Christian.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly 2,000 years ago from September 11th would have been year one in the Coptic tradition.
Well, I didn't know that.
That brings back the dollar bill and the Egyptian connection. I think these people are very, very spiritual. And I think that the key is they want to control knowledge. They don't want us to have these kinds of technologies that, you know, if you just go up and up and up in what they can do, you know, somebody can tweak the magnetic field of the Earth from their backyard or something.
They're into numerology, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting how they have so many, kind of arcane or occult traditions mixed in with this. And I kind of got this from Hoagland, and then apparently I found out that Hoagland got it from Jordan Maxwell. So
yes.
Very interesting stuff.
Absolutely. Okay, thanks, Ted. Appreciate you being part of the program. Did you ever see my favorite movies? I've mentioned it before. I'll do it again. Eyes Wide Shut?
Oh, yes.
Not one of my favorite movies, not my favorite movie. I mean,
but a very useful movie.
If you understand the Illuminati, you'll understand the movie. If you don't understand the Illuminati and what their mission is, you have no idea what that movie is.
Yeah.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Thank you. Hi, this is Bob in San Diego.
Hello, Bob.
Thanks so much for taking my call, and thank you for having Catherine on. And thank you, Catherine, for making me realize I'm not alone in the world.
Oh,
I'm a former SEC attorney from 25 years ago, and about 2 years ago I got involved in another matter, and I found exactly what you found, that they lie. I have statements on records. And when I went to report it to, I said, well, this couldn't be real. I'll report it to the Division of Enforcement. And instead of doing anything, they started making criminal threats against my client.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I was shocked. I mean,
the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah, it's like you said, I believe in white hats and the black hats, and there's good guys and good will triumph.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, what did you do in your case? Because I'm sitting here shaking, saying, do I call them up again? Will they come after me this time?
I would really encourage you to send me an email at Catherine@Solari.com, and I can send you some more stuff on dirty tricks. But if you go to my website, there's a section on litigation, and I go into a lot of these issues. If you go to the bottom of the homepage on the right, there's a whole section on litigation and many, many of these issues. But I would caution you to be extremely careful.
What would the Founding Fathers say about all this, Catherine?
Well, I think the Founding Fathers would have said if you ever give up the control of the currency from the U.S. Treasury, this is exactly what will happen.
Well, you know, that's funny because Andre, that guest I was just talking about, also talked about the fact that the Federal Reserve System is what is screwing us up, and that we need our monetary system to revert back to government.
George, because I didn't know if all the, you know, things I'd been told about the Federal Reserve were true or not, and so in a couple years ago, I wrote an email or called all the Federal Reserve banks, and I asked two questions: who owns your equity? And the second question was, who manages your databases, and do your private owners or have access to your data?
I bet you didn't get information to either question.
Well, to both questions, they said, that's a private, confidential matter. But here's what's so important that I really want everyone to hear and understand, and that is, the power in the Federal Reserve is if you have the data about how all the money works every place, every neighborhood, every county, every town, if you have all that data, then you can control an economy. That's the ultimate inside information. And so, you know, all our data is owned and controlled by private banks, and we don't know who has access to it, but we know we don't.
Pretty gutsy, Catherine. Thanks for spending the time with us on Coast to Coast. Appreciate it. Catherine Austin Fitz, website, Solari, SOLARI.com. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lautasor, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition.